This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, back to the pub. Well, for some, and with limits. But can hospitality reopen and boost the economy and keep coronavirus under control? Also, the National Cabinet hears the mental health crisis is still growing, but a $48 million response leaves some experts underwhelmed. And after US agencies warn that Chinese hackers are targeting coronavirus research, we'll ask former Australian cyber czar Alastair McGibbon how well prepared are Australian companies and governments.
We're better than we were 4 years ago. Very competent federal and state agencies, really smart businesses investing in this space. I'm a glass half full guy. The question is whether the curve we're chasing is moving faster than our improvement.
So today marks the start of a big test of Australia's ability to control coronavirus, a test of whether we can safely get the economy out of the $4 billion a week hole that is the COVID-19 lockdown. From today, the state with by far the biggest coronavirus caseload, New South Wales, is implementing its first major lifting of restrictions, allowing up to 10 people to dine at any one time in pubs, clubs, cafes and restaurants across the state. We'll head beyond New South Wales shortly, but at the onset of this crisis, we spoke with the owner of a well-known Greek restaurant on Sydney's Lower North Shore, where sales had plunged 80 to 90% because of restrictions. It's only been a few hours and there are, as we say, still limits, but the doors are back open. Business reporter David Taylor's been finding out what difference it's made.
It's late afternoon and the espresso machine at Zenos Restaurant Bar Cafe is getting a workout. Manager Dennis Zenos emerges from the back of the kitchen.
G'day, Dennis Zenos, David Taylor from the ABC. I hope you remember me from a few weeks back.
G'day, Dave. Yes, I do remember you and I can tell you things are looking a little bit better, I suppose we could say. It's still not easier per se, but it's nice to see that we at least have the opportunity to have people sitting down, even though it's only 10 at a time. As you can see behind you now, we've got nearly full. We're at 9 people, mate. We're at 9 people.
So, you know, there's an atmosphere here. There's no doubt about that. 3 separate tables, and one of them's got 5 people on them. So that's pretty good. Now, some businesses have told the ABC that they can't open until they're at full capacity. How are you making it work with less than full capacity?
Look, it all depends on what you call making it work. We're gritting our teeth. We're asking people to be understanding, all our customers be understanding, and we're trying to put a one-hour time limit on everyone when we can. It's a $50 minimum spend on lunch and dinners just to try and make it worthwhile. We can budget for, you know, for the number of staff we might need in and the products that we're going to need and a limited menu. So that's what we're trying to do to try and minimise costs from our end and also trying to make it, you know, somewhat is, you know, a nice word, you know, feasible to be here.
Dennis Zenos had to lay off close to half his staff in April. He says he's rehired those staff who haven't since found a job.
We've brought some people back on that we had to let go and who didn't have any other employment, and they basically were very happy to come back on board.
That would have been better phone calls to make than the other ones.
Absolutely. This is a much better phone call to make. To say, look, you know, if you're willing and able to come back, we would love to have you back.
Peter Strong is the CEO of the Council of Small Business. He says every business is going to have its own unique reopening experience today.
Which staff do you ask to come and work, and which ones don't you ask to come and work? So that's going to be an interesting dynamic once people start talking about it, because some staff will be quite happy to come back in. They're the ones you keep on. And others will say, no, I'm happy on JobKeeper sitting at home. I'm comfortable doing that. So there'll be a few interesting conversations out there in the workplace.
Do you think that the gradual reopening of the economy that we're seeing today will lead to enough jobs being picked up and enough staff being re-employed that we don't see that Treasury forecast of 10% for that headline rate of unemployment being achieved?
We certainly will, because businesses won't be able to open with their full complement that they had before.
And for businesses like Zenos Restaurant, it means remaining unprofitable.
I'm pretty sure we're not profitable just yet. But look, I know that this is going to be a tough time and we just need to make it happen.
Recognising that businesses across the country are, from a cash flow perspective, sticking their necks out this weekend, Scott Morrison gave them a little pep talk.
They're backing themselves, they're backing their staff, they're backing their communities and they're backing their country. And I want to commend them for that brave step that they're taking this weekend. Good on you for reopening. And I'm sure your patrons will come and to support you strongly as well.
These patrons certainly have no problem supporting their local.
Are you enjoying this afternoon, being out and about?
Yeah, we're happy to be out.
Yeah. How long have you been cooped up for? Is this the first time out at all?
Yeah, to a restaurant, yeah. What, it's been 8 weeks?
Yeah, we tend to like to do Friday lunches with the team, so that's been a bit hard not being able to have the team together all the time. So, yeah, we're excited to get out today.
And this is your best local?
Yeah, it's delicious.
Happy customer, David Taylor with that report. So the hospitality sector is spluttering back to life, and it's not just restaurants and cafes. If you're in the Northern Territory and New South Wales, some pubs are again filling with people, but with heavy restrictions. Schooners, middies, schmiddies, ponies, pots and pints will come back soon in the ACT, Queensland, WA and Tasmania. I hope we line those up right. Sorry, South Australia and Victoria, no date for pubs reopening for you yet. So, for a taste of a pub in Sydney, our reporter Alex Tai is at the Forest Lodge Hotel. Alex, what are the arrangements you're seeing for people there?
Well, Linda, there's hand sanitizer at the door and inside a few tables spread out along the room. Only 10 people are allowed in at any one time, and the rule of having just one person per 4 square meters is still in place, and people are only allowed to buy alcohol with food. Now, at the moment, I guess you could say the pub is at capacity, and because of that 10-person limit, they've even had to turn away some hopeful customers. It's first in, first served. And even though this is nowhere near as busy as it normally would be, the atmosphere is surprisingly good. For people here, it is the first time they've sat at a pub in over 8 weeks, and they're thrilled to be back in person. I spoke to two of them.
My name's Lauren.
I'm Brendan.
How does it feel being back in a pub in person?
It's amazing. It's honestly, it brings a tear to my eye. It's pretty great. Yeah.
The beer tastes better out of a tap for some reason. Yeah. I've never known why, but it does. We are both very much into pub communities and think it's an important part of any community is the pub. And so it's great to be back inside one.
Yeah.
Pubgoers loving it in Sydney. Alex Tai is our reporter. Alex, how difficult has it been for venues over the past 7 or so weeks?
It's been very difficult, Linda. For the Forest Lodge Hotel, their earnings are down by 83%. At this time of the day, the pub would usually be packed with students and staff from the nearby university. Now, those customers are, of course, missing and will be until classes resume in person. Not every pub has been in a position to reopen. The Sydney Park Hotel nearby said that the amount of revenue they would get from serving just 10 customers at a time would not cover the cost of reopening. Now, the Forest Lodge Hotel has been open for takeaway meals and alcohol this whole time, and they say that support from locals has put them in a position to reopen to patrons today. Matthew and Irene Sen are the husband and wife owners of the Forest Lodge Hotel, and they say they're glad they could reopen.
Well, it looks a lot better than it did yesterday, put it that way, when there was no one in here. So, we've tried to use the time constructively, and look, it's small steps. It's certainly better than the position we thought we were going to be in on Tuesday when Gladys said no to pubs. It is what it is, and you've just got to make the most of it.
Matthew Sen and Irene Sen, owners of the Forest Lodge Hotel. Alex Tai, our reporter in Sydney. Well, let's head to the Northern Territory because there it's the start of phase two of the easing of restrictions. That means gyms and libraries, restaurants, cafes and nail salons and pubs can open if they follow social distancing guidelines and if they kick people out after they've been there for 2 hours. Well, Oliver Gordon is our reporter in Alice Springs. Ollie, you're at a place called Monty's Bar. Is there plenty of social distancing going on there?
Hi, Linda. Yes, I am at Monty's Bar in Alice Springs. We've just had a couple of people come to the door, but they're not allowed in yet because actually Monty's isn't open for another 20 minutes. I'm with the owner of Monty's, Carl Pearson, and he's generously granted the PM team something of an exclusive. He's allowed me to come in and he's poured me the first beer of his grand reopening. Kyle Pearson, thanks for talking to PM. Now, you can reopen, but you've still got a few restrictions to deal with, such as two-hour limits and 1.5-metre social distancing requirements. How will you manage this tonight?
Yeah, thanks, Ollie. Look, we've been working pretty closely with health and the police, and they've sort of come out and done some checks. But, yeah, we've had the measuring tape out. We're fairly certain that our tables are the required distance apart. And, yeah, we'll just be monitoring this ongoing to make sure that we're doing the right thing.
And it was only a few months ago that you actually bought this bar from the previous owner and then the virus came along. How have you managed to keep it open whilst you've had to have it closed?
Look, that was absolutely bizarre. It's been a tough couple of months, that's for certain, but I guess we were sort of in a good position to ride it out for the last, I can't remember how many weeks it's been, but feels like about 2 years. But, we've ridden that out. We're in a strong position now to reopen again.
So there you go, Linda. Monty's Bar reopening again tonight under the ownership of Kyle Pearson.
And, Ollie, you're in a more urbanised part of the NT, obviously, in Alice Springs. But what's happening for people who are out bush and still locked down?
Well, Linda, while people here in Alice Springs, Catherine, Darwin, Tennant Creek are starting to get back to normal, a lot of those people out in the remote communities are still locked down under strict biosecurity laws. These laws are in place until June 18th and mean all non-essential travel to remote communities is banned and a 14-day isolation period applies for residents of those communities wanting to return home from regional centres if they've done shopping or anything like that. Earlier this week, we actually saw a development in that story, though. Two of the most powerful Aboriginal organisations here in the Territory, the Northern Land Council and the Central Land Council, called for the restrictions to be lifted 2 weeks early on June the 5th. Chief Minister of the NT, Michael Gunner, said that he supported those calls, but ultimately that decision to end the restrictions a little bit earlier lies with the Commonwealth.
Okay, thanks very much, Ollie. Oliver Gordon in Alice Springs. Well, the number of coronavirus cases in Australia has passed 7,000. Around 20 new cases are now being recorded each day nationally, with some causing more concern than others. For example, the Rockhampton nurse, whose diagnosis has now shut down an aged care home. Overall, though, the curve is still flattened and the National Cabinet has announced that elective surgery has been given the green light to resume. But one of the worries remains the impact of the crisis on mental health. And while early data from some states suggests there hasn't been an increase in suicide rates so far, the federal government did announce more funding in that area today. Here's our political reporter, Jade McMillan.
Australia's efforts to contain coronavirus are paying off in the nation's hospitals. Chief Medical Officer Brendan Murphy says there are now 50 people in hospital with COVID-19. Just 12 of them are on ventilators. And that means elective surgery can get back to normal.
In those states that are having essentially no cases, they want to go fairly quickly back to full elective activity. Those states that still have some transmission are probably going to take it a bit more gently. But everybody is now heading towards full elective surgery, which is a really important thing.
But while pressure on the general health system has eased, Health Minister Greg Hunt says the threat to the mental well-being of Australians is far from over.
The loneliness of isolation, anxiety about a job, a small business set of finances, the mortgage. All of these pressures which come with the pandemic have created specific mental health challenges.
At today's National Cabinet meeting, leaders endorsed a mental health pandemic plan, which comes with $48 million of federal government funding. The money will be spent on areas such as data and modelling and making sure services get through to vulnerable Australians, including the elderly and people with pre-existing mental health conditions, while $10 million will go towards a national communications campaign.
To say to Australians, it's okay not to be okay. Unprecedented times, anybody can feel the stress of mental health, and to say not only is it okay not to be okay, but there are pathways to help, to let everybody know that there is help.
Beyond Blue CEO Georgie Harmon has welcomed the package.
So I think there's a very strong signal around partnership and collaboration at the government level and that mental health remains at the forefront of the pandemic response.
But Professor Ian Hickey from the University of Sydney's Brain and Mind Centre says a lot more work will be needed to prevent an impending crisis.
While this package has some really good elements, it doesn't yet seem to have reached the scale or the immediacy really required now to be ready for the really significant mental health problems that we will face over the next 2 years.
Modelling produced by the Brain and Mind Centre has warned coronavirus could lead to a 25% increase in deaths by suicide. And Professor Hickey says yesterday's unemployment figures, confirming the loss of hundreds of thousands of jobs, reinforce the need for urgent improvements to the entire mental health system.
So what you haven't seen in this package is actually bringing the whole national capacity, the private and public sector together. This national cabinet is a unique opportunity to change the whole game. And I've got to ask the question, if not now, when? If we don't do it in relation to this emerging crisis, when will we ever do it?
Professor Ian Hickey from Sydney University's Brain and Mind Centre, Jade McMillan reporting. And for help for yourself or anyone you know who's struggling, Lifeline is one of the services you can call. The number is 13 11 14. This is PM. I'm Linda Mottram. You're listening on the radio, the ABC Listen app and the podcast. Ahead, both AFL and NRL will be back within a month. Fans are delighted, but we'll hear how it could all go away if public health is not taken seriously. News of two ransomware attacks affecting Australia today, one that disrupted BlueScope Steel operations worldwide, including in part their operations at Port Kembla in New South Wales, and another at an Adelaide-based money management company. They come hot on the heels of warnings from the FBI that Chinese hackers are targeting pharmaceutical research centres in the United States. One of Australia's top cyber experts says that's no surprise, and it won't just be COVID research in the US that's targeted. Alastair McGibbon was the inaugural head of the Australian Cyber Security Centre. He's now Chief Strategy Officer with CyberCX. We spoke earlier.
I have no direct knowledge, of course, but what I would say is that we have seen nation states go after intellectual property. That's the machine that runs our economies. And we know that some states are particularly interested in scientific research, biomedical research. So no great surprise that there'd be allegations that some nations are looking to steal COVID-related research data.
And Australia, of course, has significant research capacity on viruses and vaccines, all in full swing, of course, at this time as part of the global effort. Are Australian laboratories and research information at risk?
Well, we saw examples, of course, that research institutions in Australia are an attractive target. So we saw the Bureau of Meteorology and the ANU as examples of institutions with valuable data that had been breached and targeted. So it's fair to make an assumption that intelligence agencies and criminals, by the way, would be highly incented to be going after COVID-19 related research, no matter which country it's in. And of course, there's good reason for it. There's big money in it. If you get the solution faster than someone else and you preference your own companies, we certainly see some nations preferencing companies that are in their own jurisdiction. And of course, there's national pride that comes with such things. So the allegation makes sense. I have no specific information about it.
And when you say, you know, the intelligence agencies, is China our major concern? It's the name that always comes up first.
Well, there are a range of countries that have shown that they will use cyber means to advance their economies. Certainly China, Russia, North Korea and Iran are the four countries that would come up consistently in those conversations. But cyber is one of those tools that is asymmetric, and other nations, middle powers, can use cyber as an extension of their nation in a way that they can't with their traditional intelligence or military efforts. So it's those four at the top and then a whole range of countries you'd talk about.
Today we've had a couple of specific examples in the news. BlueSteel at Port Kembla after a suspected ransomware attack on the US systems of that company, and now an Adelaide-based money management company has confirmed a ransomware attack caused them a major outage since Saturday. Are we in the middle of a serious ramping up in cyber attacks generally in this country? Because those two are not specifically related to pandemic, COVID, pharmaceutical research.
Well, ransomware is one of the fastest growing crimes in the world, and that's because we're using computer systems more often and they're more complex than they ever were. And of course, cyber criminals and nation states haven't been checked. We've not added cost into their operations. So it's logical they'll expand, and it's logical that ransomware is useful for them. Look, we don't know enough where there's an uptick. We certainly know that Australian businesses are targeted by criminal groups. We know they're also targeted by nation states. We also know that nation states have used ransomware. So both North Korea and Russia in 2017 were responsible for the WannaCry and NotPetya global ransomware pandemics. They were the first global examples we've seen. And we've certainly seen nation states use cyber means for political ends. And we definitely see criminals trying to use it for money.
So how well prepared is Australia, both at the private sector level and the government level, for, you know, this burgeoning field?
I think, and I'd of course say this to you, Linda, there's been a maturation. I think it really started in 2016 with former Prime Minister Turnbull's launch of the National Cybersecurity Strategy, which I had the pleasure of to implement. Generally speaking, most people who deal with cybersecurity would say we've come a long way, but there's a long way to go before we have resilience. I'd net out by saying we're better than we were 4 years ago. Very competent federal and state agencies, really smart businesses investing in this space. I'm a glass half full guy. I'd say to you, I think we're getting better. The question is whether the curve we're chasing is moving faster than our improvement.
Alistair McGibbon, thank you for your time today.
Thanks, Linda.
Former federal cybersecurity advisor Alistair McGibbon. Well, companies that make our smartphones, household appliances, even tractors also dominate the market for the repair of those items. They use special glue in smartphones, secret software codes in appliances, and conditional warranties to stop us or our preferred repairer fixing our own stuff. And they can dictate the cost and time taken for a repair. But now some of those companies are under the spotlight for potentially breaking the law. Annie Guest reports.
There's a long history of farmers repairing their tractors and other machinery, but now it's often impossible. Matt Dull is a Queensland cattle and hay farmer and also a qualified mechanic.
Quite often to diagnose faults, you need to plug a laptop in, you need to have the dealer out. As most companies, you can't just buy the software, or it costs thousands of dollars to buy software from other manufacturers to suit this machine.
Even though you're a mechanic?
Yes, well, I'm a mechanic, but it's all about having the software and the cables that you require to plug in.
Where once they fixed machinery in the field, now a breakdown mid-harvest can threaten some farmers' entire annual income while they wait for the manufacturer's authorised repairer.
Well, it means downtime and means you don't always get the crop off when you require it under the best conditions.
Like companies that make smartphones and household appliances, the machinery manufacturers use software locks and purchasing contracts to stop people or independent repairers from fixing stuff. Instead, they can dictate the time and cost of repair. Wheat grower and chairman of Grain Producers Australia, Andrew Wiedemann, says it's unfair.
What we're talking about here is really just giving farmers the opportunity to be able to service their own machines at their own time on their own farms and make sure that they can keep their wheels rolling when they need to.
The manufacturing and service market for agricultural machinery is worth more than $175 billion worldwide. John Deere dominates one third of it. Its warranty states that it won't cover repairs done outside of its dealership network. Griffith University's Professor Leanne Wiseman says manufacturers are misusing protections never intended for their industries.
Now, we first saw technological protection measures in the 90s with music and video and to prevent piracy, essentially, of the copyright work.
The five biggest agricultural machinery and servicing companies active in Australia all declined interviews. There's a growing international push against their behaviour. The issue has even appeared in the US presidential race. Here's the former Democratic candidate, Bernie Sanders.
People are spending $150,000 for a piece of machinery. You know what? I think that the person who buys that machinery has a right to fix that damn piece of machinery.
The right to repair movement has seen laws passed in Europe to make televisions and washing machines easier and cheaper to fix, and that's set to be extended to smartphones, tablets and laptops. And now the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is examining whether agricultural manufacturers are breaking competition laws here. The ACCC's deputy chairman is Mick Keogh.
By restricting access to service information and diagnostic tools, could be creating a monopoly in terms of servicing farm machinery, and that's certainly something we'd want a serious look at.
In the US, several states are considering laws to liberalise the repair market. But in an effort to head that off, the industry has promised to share more information. And in Australia, John Deere has told PM it plans to, quote, assist customers who want more information about repairing their own equipment. Critics say the measure is insufficient, as the manufacturers won't share the essential diagnostic information with customers or independent repairers. The ACCC has released a discussion paper, which is open for public comment until the end of the month.
Annie Guest reporting, and more from Annie on that story on Landline, Sunday at 12:30 on ABC TV or on iView. Well, sport has bookended Australia's response to the coronavirus pandemic. The Prime Minister's decision not to see his beloved Cronulla Sharks play back in March, after he had earlier insisted he would, came just ahead of the mass gatherings ban. So that was a sign that things were getting serious. Now, within a month, both the Rugby League and Aussie Rules will be back, following in the footsteps of other football codes around the world. Fans are delighted, but they have been warned that if they don't take public health seriously, they could lose it all again. Bridget Fitzgerald has this report.
That's a sound that's been dearly missed by fans like Ron Greaves.
You know what? He's got it!
After a long couple of months, the Port Adelaide fan says the news that the AFL will be back on the 11th of June couldn't have come soon enough.
Fantastic news. I think it's great for everyone's mental health, for all supporters of their teams.
Trevor McKenney is the president of the Gippsland Magpies, a Collingwood fan group that travels to Melbourne from eastern Victoria for home games. Mass gatherings are still banned, so he and his mates won't be able to go to the stadium, but excitement is brewing for footy's return.
A lot of our members are getting a bit antsy now. So they'll be pretty excited, especially here in the Collingwood's going to be playing Richmond in the first game, by the sounds of things.
What have you been doing in replacement of not having any footy to watch or sport at all?
Well, getting a lot of work done around a lot of those jobs that the wife's wanted me done around the house for quite some years. Yeah, I'm really doing some catch up.
AFL returns with strict protocols in place, and players will be sanctioned if they don't abide by the rules. Teams from WA and South Australia are set to relocate to the Gold Coast so as not to breach isolation measures in their states. There'll be risk assessments on visitors to players and their families, and a plan for twice-a-week testing. AFL CEO Gillon McLachlan outlined some of these measures this afternoon.
All players are undergoing education sessions on the protocols they will need to follow, including rigorous ongoing screening and regular testing throughout both the training and return to play period.
Meanwhile, the NRL will be back even sooner, with a Thursday night game between the Broncos and the Eels on the 28th of May. Although a Queensland government requirement for compulsory flu vaccinations has created some controversy this week, with some players refusing to comply. Acting NRL Chief Executive Andrew Abdo told the media today there would be a no jab, no play rule for Queensland.
Players that haven't been vaccinated or don't have a medical exemption for vaccination won't be permitted to play.
Football's making a comeback overseas as well. The German Bundesliga will become the world's first major football league to return on Saturday, while the English Premier League is set to be back in June. Medical experts, however, want to stress the return of football codes doesn't signal an end to the pandemic. Dr. Tony Bartone is the president of the Australian Medical Association.
We cannot afford to see any more slip-ups.
NRL players Latrell Mitchell, Josh Adokar and Nathan Cleary were found to have breached physical distancing measures last month, while 16 Adelaide Crows players were handed a one-match ban for failing to maintain physical distancing during training. Dr. Bartone says those kinds of mistakes won't be tolerated.
Any slip-up will see the reimposition of restrictions, but worse still, will risk second waves and some of the unforeseen consequences that we've been so lucky to avoid thus far in our fight against COVID-19.
President of the Australian Medical Association, Dr. Tony Bartone, with Bridget Fitzgerald. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.